This is an NPR special. A little more than a week ago, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak resigned after thousands of Egyptians protested in the streets for a more democratic and free government. During those 18 days of protests, violent outbreaks occurred. In many cases, demonstrators and journalists were attacked. For a perspective on the situation on the ground, the Hayerty School of Governance and Human Rights Watch organized a panel discussion with experts in the field. The guests include Katrine Zandman, a longtime Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. Zandman is now the head of international documentaries at Cobalt Productions in Berlin. Christoph Vilke, senior researcher for the Middle East at Human Rights Watch. And Eldad Beck, the Berlin-based correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Yediot. The discussion is moderated by Vinzel Michalski. Michalski opens up the discussion by asking Eldad Beck if he felt Egypt was an especially dangerous place right now for an Israeli journalist.
Well, it's a very complicated question because, first of all, my personal experience was a relatively positive one. However, one should know that although Egypt is one of the very rare Arab and Muslim countries who have peace with Israel, and although Israelis should have the possibility to travel into Egypt, from the moment trouble started in Cairo and elsewhere in Egypt, Israeli journalists were not allowed to get entry visas to Egypt, and thus enabled them, actually, in the very first days of this great movement to do their work. I have a European passport, which enables me to go to other Arab countries to which Israelis are not allowed at all to enter. And this is the way myself and some other Israeli journalists managed to get into Egypt at the very beginning of the whole movement. It became uneasy from the moment that the pro-Mubarak started operating, and that was about a week after the first big demonstration in Cairo, because I found myself, although I do not necessarily present myself as an Israeli, since I'm working also for some other newspapers in Europe, I found myself in a situation where on the side of the anti-Mubarak demonstrators, the Israelis were blamed for supporting Mubarak, and Mubarak was named an agent, the head of the Mossad even, by many of them. And there was a very, very strong, not general, however, very strong anti-Semitic feeling. And then started a week afterwards, all of a sudden, the pro-Mubarak action, and they came to the streets shouting that the Israelis are behind the anti-Mubarak demonstrators. And that was a week before everything started, after everything started. And at that night, it was Tuesday after the second speech of Mubarak, in which he said that he was not going to candidate himself for the presidency in September, that I felt that the situation is becoming very delicate, because all of a sudden we were attacked, virtually from all sides. Myself, I was attacked by a woman while I was talking to a pro-Mubarak supporters. It was actually a very strange night because there was the speech of Mubarak very late at night, around 10, 30, 11. And in the days before, the movement in the streets stopped. Everybody went to Tahrir Square. They had their rallies up until to midnight. And then around 1 o'clock, most of the people left home, although there was curfew, and a very small group stayed there to keep control of the area. And the streets were empty. And all of a sudden, two hours after the speech of Mubarak, I slept with an open window at my hotel room, which was next to the Tahrir Square. I hear people going through the streets and shouting. There were all of a sudden demonstrations again. And I didn't understand what was going on, and I went down, and I was really surprised that it was a pro-Mubarak movement. And I asked, I started talking to the people. I speak Arabic, and I said, wait a minute, where have you been this last week? Why all of a sudden you come into the streets? Now, luckily, apparently, since it was the beginning of this pro-Mubarak movement, which was much smaller than the anti-Mubarak, but still, apparently, I had luck because I met people of, let's say, people who were not very aggressive. Most of them were working for the government, but they were really not somebody who you can call gangs. And they engaged with me a very interesting discussion. And all of a sudden came this woman, and she heard that I was not that I was a journalist through the questions. And then she really attacked me, pushing me and saying, "Oh, it's because of you, because of the foreigners, because of the foreign media, everything that is happening now, etc." And actually, I had a double problem at that moment, because not only I was Israeli, I'm going around with an Austrian passport. Now, why is Austria a problem? Because Al-Bardai, one of the leaders of the opposition, spent almost 30 years in Austria. So the pro-Mubarak people, the moment they heard that I was from Austria, said, "But you brought this Al-Bardai upon us. You are..." So it was... from this moment on, not very clear what is what's worse, and but then they were, and then those I was speaking to, who were men, pushed the woman away, told me, "Don't pay attention to her; she's crazy," and they told me that they were going to Atahrir Square, where I knew that there were pro-Mubarak, anti-Mubarak people, and then I said, "Well, let's go with them and see what's happening," because I mean, if anything is going to happen, this is where it's going to happen. Now, the entrance to the square was up until this moment, for mainly for foreigners, free. All you had to do is to come up with your passport, show it, and they wouldn't even check you. The Egyptians had to show their ID card, and they were physically checked to make sure that no provocateurs from the pro-Mubarak camp would get inside and try to make provocations. However, that very night, apparently because people knew that something was about to happen, it wasn't that easy anymore, which means that the Egyptians, the pro-Mubarak Egyptians, were allowed into the place, without into the square, without any control whatsoever. The moment I showed my passport, civilians who pretended to be guards stopped me and very aggressively started asking me what I was doing there. And then I said, "Well, I'm a journalist." Now, most of us journalists did not get into Egypt with a journalist visa, because we wouldn't have gotten the visa. We came as tourists. And then they told me, "Well, if so, where is your press accreditation?" And I said, "Well, you know, I forgot it in the hotel, and until now I didn't really need it." So, and then they really became aggressive, and it was a very uneasy situation, fortunately enough. And one has to really understand that the Egyptians are not as... they're really nice people, most of them, even in such extreme situations. And fortunately enough, there was an army officer standing not very far away from it, because it was the entrance to the square, who was blocked by the army. And I sort of looked at him, and he saw that there is a problem, and he decided to intervene, and he took me out and asked me to go back to the hotel. I do know that many of my colleagues had other experiences. However, I think that it is also important to ask if all my colleagues who were attacked, and for a large extent they were attacked in an organized way, but not only, if they, to a certain point, did not push the situation where people felt a little bit provoked by them, and thus brought upon themselves problems. I'm not saying that everybody is doing that, but I have experienced in my own my own professional life situations where journalists are a little bit pushing situation in order to become themselves the story. And I do believe that from the moment on attacks on journalists started, there were quite a few journalists who really wanted to be the story instead of just covering the story. And this is also something that should be said. We are in a very delicate situation. We are not allowed to be actors. Therefore, yeah, this is something that should be discussed. There are many, many points which I would like to bring into discussion, and maybe we should do it also later on. But I think that we have to be extremely careful with the way that we are reporting about what's happening there. I think that there is some feeling of euphoria that now everything is going to be fantastic and great in in Arabia and democracy is coming upon us and everything. And on the other side, I experienced in Egypt itself, but also when I came back here in the West, some sort of diabolization of Mubarak and his people. I think that we really have to be very careful with what we are doing, because when we are saying that Egypt was a dictatorship or that Mubarak was a dictator, I think that, and don't take me wrong, I'm not, although Mubarak and I were born the same day, I'm not...
You look much younger.
Yeah, not the same year, the same day. I'm not necessarily fond of him, and I will explain later why. And it wasn't a democracy, it wasn't a semi-democracy, however, it was not a dictatorship. In a real dictatorship, what we have seen in Egypt and Tunisia would not be able to happen. I mean, this is the reason why these things are not really happening the way they should in Iran, for example, or in Syria. I mean, there was an attempt to do it in Syria some 2 weeks ago. Yeah, there was the opposition called for huge demonstrations. There were more policemen in the streets than demonstrators. So it is not, maybe it is, we have to be very careful with our definitions. Now, what are we talking about when we are saying democracy? Do we really believe that from in one day democracy could be achieved in such a country that does not have at all any democratic experience? There is this tendency to make comparisons with what happened in East Europe 20 years ago. I'm not so sure that this is the real comparison, because it's absolutely another political mentality and culture and history. And by giving away too easily things, I think that we will lose in a way our objectivity when we come to judge the situation as it is or as it should be. Now we're coming to another problematic. Are we at all, Westerns, Europeans, Americans, Israelis, whatever, are we in a situation to give the Egyptians any lessons about democracy? With all due respect, I don't think that Europe is democratic. The European Union is not democratic at all. And think about how democracy evolved in some European countries, especially in the last 20 years. Think about Austria, for example, where you have, I mean, the fascists is the third largest country. We are sitting in a country where the democracy allows to a neo-Nazi party to be elected. So can we give the Egyptians any lessons about anything? I mean, America, the great America, it is not a country where there is one vote, one man, one vote. Because at the end of the day, if you sum up all the votes of the people, you don't get the result normally. You don't get the result of the election. So we should be very modest and very careful when we try to give those who hopefully would come to democracy any lessons. I think that we should be ready to help them at any moment if they ask for help. I do not think that we should force help upon them. They should ask for it. And I think that we have to make it clear for ourselves, first of all, if we know what democracy really is, because democracy doesn't mean voting or election. If you bring into election parties who have absolutely nothing to do with democracy, and this country knows exactly what I'm talking about, we haven't done anything by pushing too fast and too far democratic experiments.
Thanks for that inside view. Let's talk about the freedom of speech, because this is one of the most prominent demands of the protesters and the new movement. Katrin, please, can you tell us about the role of the new media and the old media and the censorship in the region? Because as far as we know and what was written in newspapers, newspaper articles, the media was the driving force at the beginning of the demonstrations.
Well, some say it was, some say it wasn't. You know, there's this big discussion going on about, you know, what did Facebook actually achieve, what didn't it achieve. I think, you know, it played a role. You know, if it was, you know, the core thing for this revolution, I doubt it. But, you know, I'm not exactly an expert on new media. What I can say, though, is, you know, certainly something needs to be done about freedom of expression and press freedom in Egypt. That's no question. And, you know, if you ask the Egyptians themselves, you know, that's exactly what they say. Let me quote Ahmed Suhail, the Egyptian Nobel prize laureate who might be a contender for the presidency in the upcoming elections, if they really happen in 6 months. That remains to be seen. He said we need a totally new media policy in the country. Zuhail is part of the so-called Council of Wise Men that was formed just before Mubarak resigned. He's there with a couple of other people, and they wrote a list of demands for the government that was then relayed to the High Military Council that is now running the country. And point five of the lists, in point five of this list, he's calling for, and I quote him again, a revolution of the state media in Egypt and more freedom of privately owned media outlets. And I think, you know, he certainly has a point. If I can be a little bit theoretical, you know, because Eldad was so nice and, you know, he has been there, it was such a nice account. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention stated in regard to Egypt that the fundamental right of freedom of opinion and expression, which is the core basis of the human rights system, as you said, must prevail even when it implies political criticism. In other words, you should not go to prison for criticizing the ruler of your country, you know, may he be the president, the military ruler, or a king. Unfortunately, no one in Egypt listened in the past, and presumably it's still very difficult for media, especially Egyptian media, these days. Restriction on press freedom have a very long history in Egypt, and I don't want to bore you with too much detail, but, you know, I thought it was very interesting that more than 100 years ago, in 1909, there was the first demonstration in Egypt, in Cairo, for press freedom. More than 100 years ago, thousands of people marched against the so-called publication law, and this publication law gave the authorities the ability to close newspapers according to their will. Until a week ago, it was not only newspapers, but satellite stations that were being closed. The Qatar-based Arabic news channel Al Jazeera is certainly the most famous example of that. It got its license to broadcast revoked by the authorities after showing live pictures from Tahrir Square when the government didn't want the world to see those pictures anymore. 25 offices of TV stations, foreign and national, were closed or smashed in recent weeks, especially in this, you know, very violent day of this protest. 76 journalists were detained for at least 2 hours or much longer, and 79 journalists were physically attacked. All these figures are according to Reporters Without Borders, the French section, the main section of them. A Belgian journalist was less lucky than Eldad was, and he reported what many others have endured. I quote him, he said, "It was very violent. I received a stream of blows in the face. They claimed that I was pro-Baradei. And then I was taken to military barracks to the outskirts of town. He was held there for 2 or 3 days, and then he was released. He was not physically harmed anymore, but very intimidated, and he left the country." This is nothing compared to what the Egyptian journalist had to endure in the past, let's say, you know, decade. Last year, some really horrific pictures of a young man's battered and deformed face appeared on the internet. Some of you might recall that. It led to very angry demonstrations in the streets of Alexandria long before these actual demonstrations on Tahrir Square. The dead young man in the pictures was a blogger, and he was very critical to the Egyptian government, notably to President Mubarak. Khaled Said's skull was fractured, his jaws dislocated, his nose broken, among other things. According to his family, Khaled was tortured to death by the police. Police denied those charges, despite eyewitness accounts that claim they saw it. An investigation of the Attorney General, there was even two investigations of the Attorney General, and the outcome of these investigations was that the injuries on the body of this young blogger were in fact the result of beatings during detention, but that he didn't die because of the beatings, which basically means beatings during his arrest are perfectly fine as long as people don't die of them. There's still a lot of argument about this case, and I don't know if they will take it up again or not. It's pretty much in the open as far as I know. So there was no freedom of expression in the last years of Mubarak's Egypt, and I think there's still no freedom of expression. Countless people, journalists, and people who voice their public opinion are still in detention, as you quoted in your opening statement. But there are signs that change might be coming, and I say that, you know, with you know, respect, because it's only very, you know, small signs. And it's not only from the Facebook and Twitter folks that are very active, and you all can follow them. During the last 3 weeks, the Egyptian press became more and more outspoken. More private newspapers and television channels lost the fear of the powerful Ministry of Information that controlled them before, as the protesters on Tahrir Square lost their fear of the police. While state-run television still tried to go along with the versions of events as the government wanted to see them, newspapers started showing pictures of the dead and the injured. They interviewed their families and friends and eyewitness accounts. Talk show hosts all of a sudden demanded the release of political prisoners, something never seen before on Egyptian television, at least. And several government-owned newspapers, most surprising, the staff of these newspapers, have threatened to oust the state-appointed editors. Let me close by saying that the military leadership, the promised, you know, or gave in to certain demands of the protesters. As we know, you know, they promised elections in 6 months. There's a working group to amend the constitution or even write an entirely new one that's up in the open. In this group, most of the people who are sitting in this, I think it's eight people, most of them are constitutional lawyers, but there is a member from the Muslim Brotherhood involved, so the opposition. So all these are very promising signs, but I think, you know, the way that the military rulers in the coming week or even month, you know, up on the path to elections, the way they will, you know, treat the press and will handle the press will, you know, give us a pretty clear indication whether or not they're serious with all the promises they made to the people so far.
Christoph, let's talk about the ripple effect. What's going on in Yemen, Bahrain, everywhere, Syria, everywhere, demonstrators demand freedom, freedom of speech, freedom to express themselves, democracy. Do we see a big change there?
Indeed. Who's next? Everybody's next. The Middle East, North Africa is a region rife with repression, unparalleled in the world. I just counted in my head off the number of countries in that region that that do not allow Human Rights Watch researchers into the country. There are six out of maybe 15 countries we cover. Yemen doesn't allow us in. I'm banned from Yemen. I'm banned from Saudi Arabia. Tunisia used to ban us. Libya bans us. Saudi Arabia, I already said. Syria, Iran, the list goes on. You don't have that elsewhere. And I want to pick up where you just left off. Clearly, demands for freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, the civil liberties, we may call them, are a part of this uprising that we're seeing across the region, underpinned, I would say, by feelings of economic disenfranchisement on the parts of many. But what I want to argue to you is that what we're seeing in other countries in the region right now does have very regional, very local, and different causes than what we have seen in Tunisia and in Egypt. And let's just go through the list a little bit. I want to say that I don't think in other countries you're seeing as much as in Egypt and Tunisia the people against the government, the people against the regime. You're seeing parts of the population against parts of the other population. If you look at Yemen, Yemen has been in crisis for at least 3 years, if not 6 years, if you count the civil war that has been raging in northern Yemen since 2004. Thousands of people have died, one of the biggest populations of displaced persons in the world right now. Nobody cared really before 2008 and 2009. In southern Yemen, used to be an independent state until unification after the wall fell in 1990, the big era of political change. And for the past 3 years, hundreds of thousands of people have been on the street in southern Yemen, first demanding a greater economic share of Yemen's wealth and resources. But since 2007, they have one very clear demand, and that is secession. We want to become an independent state again. So in Yemen, what we've seen over the past week is the long-standing southern protests merging with the general opposition that exists around the country into demonstrations in Sana'a, in the capital. And this may bode more trouble for President Saleh, the second longest ruling person in the region. I think he's clocked up 33 years now. Muammar al-Gaddafi has a little more, but maybe he'll get there. If the situation in Yemen continues where it's going right now. More popular protests, more demands from leading intellectual circles on the president to step down, to change, etc. I don't think we will see a unified opposition or an opposition that will go down the path of democracy. I think it will be very clear that the southerners will want to break away, that the people who've been running the northern civil war, the Houthis, the Zaydi Shia, that they will also want to carve out some kind of autonomous rule there. So in Yemen, you don't have the people versus the regime. The one thing they all agree on is the incredible amount of corruption that goes on. That's sort of their underpinning grievance there. If we move a little up to Bahrain, in Bahrain as well, the protests started well before Tunisia and Egypt. Bahrain went from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional monarchy in around 2003 or two, I believe. The new king instituted some political changes there. He banned torture, which Human Rights Watch documented only came back around 2009. But they were planning for an election in, I think it was August or September 2010. And in the month or two before those elections, the government cracked down on the main opposition party, which is a Shia party. Bahrain is a country that has about 70% Shia majority, ruled by a smaller Sunni minority. And one of our advisory committee members from the Middle East and North Africa at Human Rights Watch was arrested as part of a group of, I think, 22 human rights activists, and they're now being charged with terrorism. This crackdown in Bahrain preceded Egypt and Tunisia. It is about public freedoms. It is about economic disenfranchisement, discrimination against Shia in the government sector, jobs, etc. But if this goes forward, becomes a more popular uprising again, you will not see the people against the government. You will see a large group identified as Shia wanting to carve more rights out from the system. In Jordan, I've been a little bit surprised that anybody actually did go on the street and protest in Jordan. I'm not quite clear yet on how to understand the situation, but I think there are different types of grievances in Jordan that haven't yet coalesced around any common denominator. Jordan and Morocco are often held up as the more liberal regimes in the Middle East, but when it comes to press freedom, Jordan is certainly a country where you go to jail if you criticize the king. As a matter of fact, I've worked on a few of those cases last year and just saw one of the guys whose trial for insulting the king is still going on. He spent 45 days in pretrial detention, was roughed up, etc. You have in Jordan the fault lines that run along the Jordanians of Palestinian origin and the Jordanians who are East Bank Jordanians, let's say the original Jordanians. Those fault lines are emerging clearer and clearer. There has already been for over a year a large hot debate in Jordan whether the Jordanians of Palestinian origin who have full citizenship, are equals in law and supposedly in practice, whether they're really Jordanians of second class, whether they really only have Jordanian citizenship until the day, such as it may be, there's a peace treaty with between Palestinians and Israelis, and they can all go back. And right now, the two groups can agree on a system needed for elements of political reform, on elements of improved free speech, assembly, and so on, but where they completely differ is the economic spoils. The East Bank Jordanians work in the government jobs, the security services, and the Jordanians of Palestinian origin run the country's businesses, basically. And they cannot agree on sort of equal citizenship. As a matter of fact, I just worked on a case of one parliamentary candidate for the 2010 elections in November who was arrested because, what did he do? He called for equality, and that was enough to get him arrested. So there hasn't been yet a coalition of demands in Jordan. There are some economic demands there, the potato, tomato throwers in the Ruhr Valley, but they haven't linked up their demands to political demands. So I don't see yet in Jordan any movement coming for popular change. If it does come, I think we'll see a sharp divide between these two camps that both of them don't like the king and the government. We can go to Iran and look at what's happening there. Of course, the popular protests in Iran long preceded Tunisia and Egypt. It was after the fraudulent election in June 2009 that hundreds of thousands of Iranians went to the street. And Iran is interesting. It seems to me sort of the last case of ideological defense of the regime. I mean, this is repression for the sake of the Iranian revolution and its high ideals and so on. And in Iran, I do see the possibility of a more Egypt-like scenario where there aren't so many diverse groups, where the economically disenfranchised, the intellectuals, and the students, where they all have very similar demands. However, the state apparatus of repression is very refined and very brutal in Iran. So even since the suppression of the June demonstrations, which came up again in December 2009, there haven't been these large demonstrations until recently, now, and we'll see how it goes, how many sacrifices the Iranians are willing to make. So this is just to give you a little bit of an overview of different fault lines of protest running around the region. There's no doubt in my mind that they are inspired by the successful topplings of the leaders in Tunisia and Egypt, but I think as they develop, we will see different types of outcomes in these countries. We haven't mentioned states like Saudi Arabia and Syria that have just preemptively clamped down on any type of dissent. And I mean, Saudi Arabia runs multiple Guantanamos, which nobody ever mentions. Thousands of people behind bars without trial for years. That brings me maybe to the last point I wanted to make. What does the European Union, what do the European Union countries and the United States say about these governments? They've now jumped on the bandwagon and congratulated the people of Tunisia and the people of Egypt, but there is a very stark difference in public pronouncements and foreign policy towards, let's take Iran and Saudi Arabia, two religiously legitimated regimes with an apparatus of repression that's refined and brutal. And yet there are daily statements, or there were at one point out of the State Department in Washington, condemning Iran for this, that, and the other, echoing many of Human Rights Watch's statements. But I've never heard any public statement on Saudi Arabia, either from Westerwelle, from the European Union, or from the State Department. And some governments don't have a lot in their toolbox. They have two things. They can either speak out publicly, and we at Human Rights Watch say that's very necessary, but they also have the concrete toolbox of conditioning their cooperation, especially when it comes to aid. We have three countries who receive enormous amounts of aid in the region: Egypt, Israel, and Jordan. And we have fought a very uphill battle in the American Congress and with European governments to even tweak parts of this aid that the governments give our taxpayers' money on human rights conditionalities. Maybe we're silly to introduce the idea. What came up in the end was the American Congress conditioned parts of the aid to Egypt on Egypt cooperating and blocking the tunnels to Gaza. Nothing on Jordan, even though it would be in Jordan's interest, I think, to make parts of the 100 million budgetary support, it's free cash that they're giving them, on human rights improvements, but that has not happened. So when I hear foreign governments say, yes, we support democracy, whenever the foreign minister goes on a trip or the head of state goes on a trip, I really doubt that. They usually want to have one case of a human rights defender who's been harassed that they can bring up in their meeting and then go home with a good conscience. But when it comes to imposing the real conditions that would help human rights in the country, then we don't hear anything. And that's where I'll conclude. Eldad threw up the good question, should we give good advice? And your answer was only if asked. On democracy, we're in the business of giving advice, and maybe that's the difference between democracy and human rights a little bit. These countries have signed treaties obliging them already to respect human rights. The advice we're giving are to respect their own obligations, and we will very much make recommendations to Tunisia and Egypt in the transitional periods, as well as to the other governments who are now sort of feeling the pressure for political reform. And I do believe that it's very important to tweak the repressive laws early and quickly before you have a popular referendum, let's say, on whether criticizing the king should be a criminal offense or not, because then you may have a hard time persuading the public.
This is NPR FM Berlin 104.1. You're listening to a panel discussion on the human rights situation in Egypt from the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin. During the last month of protests in Cairo, Human Rights Watch has been following specific cases of violence and violations of free speech against protesters and journalists covering the events. We'll hear more from our panel of guests after this break.
1 minute after 5 in the morning.
In Colombia, a coal mine explosion has killed at least
1 minute after noon.
Top military leaders at the Pentagon are defending the decision.
1 minute after 5 in the evening.
Russia's parliament has ratified the new START.
1 minute after 11 at night.
Federal judicial vacancies have reportedly.
What's happening? What's known? What's next? 1 minute after the hour. Every hour. Every day. From NPR News.
You're listening to NPR FM Berlin. A panel of guests recently met at the Hertie School in Berlin to discuss the human rights situation in Egypt. During the 18 days of protests that led to President Hosni Mubarak's resignation, several violations of free speech and assembly have been reported. We return now to our panel discussion.
Thank you, Alad. Do you want to answer?
Very, very briefly, because I think that we agree basically. Maybe I didn't make myself clear enough. I don't think that we are in a position to. I'm not so sure that we are in a position to give them good advice, because I'm not so sure that we have been through everywhere where it is a real democratic process. However, I think that we should be there to eventually, if we are asked to give advice and recommendation, if we can, but we should not dictate any position. And I am afraid that, especially if I'm looking at the American position regarding the Egyptian crisis, that once again the American administration came up as dictating the situation, obliging a certain outcome of the crisis. And from what I heard from people there, they were really fed up with it. And what I also heard from people there is, and that was really a big surprise for me, because I thought that Obama would be somebody that would be appreciated for, you know, whatever he tried to change. They told me this guy went and bowed before the king of Saudi Arabia. This man didn't say a word when the Iranians made their own revolution and at the end, we're not able to change anything. And now he's coming to us and telling us what to do. I think there is a little fed up. We should not, once again, it's a very delicate situation. There are enough forces in the Arab world, and also Arabs living abroad, who have, I believe, ideas that would enable to change the situation. And I think that we should give respect to the people of this region in their quest of democracy. That doesn't mean that we have to accept everything they are saying and everything that they are doing, because based on our errors, we should be able to say, stop, you're going in the wrong direction.
But, you know, it doesn't mean like, you know, giving advice on democracy, I mean, or giving advice in general. First of all, I think there's a big difference between the United States and Europe, especially in this region. Second, sometimes, you know, they did ask for help. Tunisia did ask for help. And, you know, first thing they're asking for is financial help. Okay, so if you see what's happening in Egypt right now, you had the, you know, Tahrir Square protest revolution, whatever you want to call it. And now what's going on? Like, ever since, you know, they kind of emptied the square and went back to normal, there's demonstration strikes more from the police, from, you know, public servants, from doctors, ambulance drivers, everybody. And what they demand is a better pay. They want money because, you know, they are living in bad circumstances. So, you know, here's one point. You know, how long are these people going to be patient, you know? They hear, you know, stuff like democracy and freedom and liberty and I don't know what. You know, regarding the history, probably they don't really know what it is besides election, or a lot of them at least. And, you know, how long are they going to be patient? And I think, you know, this is a very delicate situation. And there is something that could be done, you know, besides human rights. And that is, you know, some sort of, you know, financial support or advice. And the same, you know, the same thing in Tunisia. So, you know, this is something that you don't have to put upon governments or people, but maybe that, you know, would be very helpful. And I think, you know, is, you know, thankfully accepted if offered.
Christoph, so is this what's happening there, what's happened in Tunisia and what's happened in Egypt, a movement more driven by poverty or by the urge of freedom and democracy?
Well, I think in Tunisia, certainly it started out in Kasserine with a movement of people who were fed up at having no chance at a government job or at private sector jobs. I think in Egypt was a little different. In Egypt was more the new media getting the politically active youth out on the street, and then it grew and drew in the other people. But you said we shouldn't give advice. Who's
no,
we?
We should be very careful.
Okay, but we,
only,
who's...
Only when asked.
Well, I disagree, so we have a good conversation going on. I want to give advice, and by we, the people who are giving advice, Human Rights Watch is entirely in accordance with the demands of many Egyptian human rights organizations. We are on the same line. We are is not the West giving advice to the Egyptians. We is the human rights community trying to make our demands heard. And this period is now crucial. If we don't get the repressive laws and practices out of the system now, we're probably not going to be able to do it again. So that's why I think we should raise our voices very loudly. And we can speak in very concrete terms. The institutions necessary for a democracy, wherever the chips fall, those are a large part have to do with human rights. You mentioned freedom of expression. We need to get out the laws that criminalize defaming somebody. Yes, you can be sued in court for civil penalties, but you should not go to jail for it. And part of the anger on the street is driven by people who have felt the brutal repression of the state for just speaking out. There's a journalist in Yemen who the intelligence thugs disappeared from the street as he was getting out cash from an ATM. And a few months later, I asked the Minister of Interior, do you have him? Do you know where he is? And it's like, no, we're looking for him. And then 2 weeks later, the intelligence drove him in their car to court to accuse him of, what was it, undermining the unity of the state or something like that. They had him all the time. But they felt so comfortable to lie to the public and to us that they saw no penalty in it. Another institution, not a law, the independence of the judiciary will be a very important point to push right now. Let's say the detention system in Jordan is under the police. We know best practice around the world is to put it under the Ministry of Justice. If those can be measures that we can put in place now, there is a chance of vastly decreasing what is routine torture in Jordan and was routine torture and seems to still be going on in Egypt. You mentioned the Khalid Said Facebook page that got some of these protests started in Egypt. That guy was tortured to death, and that was what fueled some of this anger. So it has to do with some of these elements of repression, certainly also economic disenfranchisement and unrest, but not only.
Eldad, we saw demonstrations also in the West Bank, and it seemed that the Palestinian authorities just couldn't stomach that there was not an anti-Israeli demonstration, but a demonstration for fair elections. What's going on there? What's going on in the West Bank? What's going on in Gaza? Will we see something like what we just experienced also in these regions?
I haven't got the slightest idea. I believe that it might also happen there. I believe that we also saw in Gaza some demonstrations which were against the Hamas government. So, I mean, they are not... I think that we are dealing here, it would be wrong to think that we are dealing with something new that is just happening. I think that in the last 10 years we have been witnessing things that have been happening in this area and we have been ignoring it because it was not really, according to what we believe to have known about this area. But come on, the Lebanese people have managed to throw out the Syrian forces 5 years ago. That was 6 years ago, with a huge, massive population mobilization, and then they came back. But this is thanks to the international community, who didn't do anything to stop it. But this was the first thing, and then we saw what happened in Iran. So things are happening. I mean, we are living in a world which is completely different, a world which is very much under influences from all over the you know, Muslims don't only go to vacation in Switzerland, they go to vacation in Indonesia and Malaysia. And there they see a democratic Islam, more or less. And they come back to their countries and say, wait a minute, why can't we have it? Now, you had the question, was it poverty or was it fight for liberty? What I kept on hearing from people is that they feel, and from different parts of the society, they feel deeply humiliated in their daily lives. And it has to do with the fact that they have to corrupt bureaucrats in order to get whatever. the fact that, you know, in Egypt, for example, I think that it was an insult, the preparation of a presidential monarchy, which means moving from father to son, exactly as happened in Egypt and probably would happen in Gaddafi, was an insult for many, many Egyptians who said, wait a minute, we are not anymore in those pharaonic times. It's not a kingdom anymore. We are supposed to be others. And they are open to what's happening in the world. There are a lot of going and coming to all sorts of countries. And I think that it's a huge movement that is happening. I just really can hope that it would move on the right track. You said that the Palestinian authorities were happy that for once it was not an anti-Israeli demonstration. I myself experienced, I would really say, not only anti-Israeli, but a very strong anti-Semitic feeling where everybody is just throwing the responsibility on the Jews, who have to be everywhere. I mean, Mubarak was Jewish and his opponents were Jewish. And when I came to Tunisia, actually, they were looking for Mossad agents who were behind what was happening in the country. And in the newspapers, I mean, they might be in Egypt, the freedom of press is not that big, but there was one point where the freedom of press was since ever very open, and that was anti-Semitism.
No, they were just attacking it.
It was directed by the government, but also by the opposition. Al-Wafd, if you read the newspapers.
Yeah, there was full unity about that.
And this is a problem, because if we get to a situation where instead of taking responsibilities, and this is democracy, democracy means taking responsibility for your doings. Instead of coming to this situation, we will find whole nations throwing responsibilities on some virtual enemies, may it be Obama or the Mossad, the Jews or the Christians. We should not forget what happened in Alexandria 2 months ago, and this is not over yet. We would be facing a huge problem. So I think we have to respect what people are saying, but we really have not to be blind to what has happened there and what is happening there, and to open our eyes and see that things can go in every possible directions. We have a military government in Egypt. It was not the case until 2 weeks ago. And even in Tunisia, I'm not so sure that it's going to be, as we all wish it would be. And the situation is still very open.
I would like also to know from Katrin and from Christoph what they think will the future bring. More democracy or terrible, disaster Islamic regimes?
I can make this very short. I think, Honestly, I didn't, see Tunisia coming till it happened.
Nobody
saw it. Yeah, well, I'm not the only one, certainly. When Egypt started, I would never have predicted that it would end, with Mubarak resigning or being resigned or being whatever. It's hard to predict anything. I mean, we heard what's going on everywhere. There's demonstrations this afternoon in Libya. Something, surprising to me. I thought, people would never dare go out on the street, given, the enormous amount of secret police and secret services and whatever they have. For Egypt, the first signs, of this high military council, everything I hear is promising. You know, I mean, there's this the protest movement from the square that had meetings with the military. There is meetings between the opposition and the ruling party, which is, you know, that they, you know, start some sort of conversation. I think, you know, is astonishing. And I want to be optimistic, and, you know, I just want to believe that this might be heading in the right direction. As for the other countries, I think you must be stupid to try and predict something. I have no idea, honestly.
Christoph?
Well, you gave the bird's eye view. Let me try to give the longer view. I think what the last 5-10 years have shown in the Middle East, North Africa, is that where human rights was the... was an area that, you know, a few ex-leftist nationalist failed politicians dabbled in after their political career failed. Now human rights are key demands by an educated, at least high school educated, young population. The amount of the centrality of human rights demands now has never been there before, for free speech, for due process in the judiciary. That will, I think, continue. But whether this awareness leads to an empowerment is a different question. These small groups and the broader awareness, they will have to harness what will become increasingly dismal economic straits for the young and unemployed and women in the region. As awareness has grown, repression has also grown in the region. The laws for setting up an NGO have gotten worse over the past 3-4 years in Bahrain, in Egypt, in Jordan, etc. Now in Jordan you need the Prime Minister's approval to get funding from, let's say, the EU for any kind of NGO project. And of course that takes time. So you have these two trends. Where it will go in the future, I don't know. You said it well. There are no democratic institutions in any of those countries where people take responsibilities for crimes committed, fraud, embezzlement, or for bad political decisions. Those don't exist. So even if there is a change in government or in the leadership, we do not have these institutions to build on. That would be the responsibility of foreign governments to help build those institutions, but not only through dialogue, please, with facts on the ground. And that's what I'm not seeing yet. So I'm also not predicting it.
This is NPR FM Berlin. You've been listening to an NPR special from the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin and Human Rights Watch. The panelists included Katrin Zandmann, the head of international documentaries at Cobalt Productions in Berlin, Christoph Wilke, senior researcher for the Middle East at Human Rights Watch, and Eldad Beck, the Berlin-based correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Yediot. For program information, blog updates, and for the latest news, please visit nprberlin.de. And for more information about the lecture series, you can visit hertie-school.org or hrw.org. The recording engineers for this program were Silviu Mihai and Pavel Conrad of the Hertie School. You're listening to 104.1 FM.